I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania has the dubious distinction of being one of the most gerrymandered states in the country, with its infamous and Rorschach-shaped 7th congressional district described as looking like Daffy Duck kicking Goofy. And while Democratic candidates running for the House got about half of the popular vote in Pennsylvania in recent elections, they hold just 5 seats in Congress, while the Republicans have 13. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court called for a new congressional map and created one of their own, unveiled this week, that does give Democrats a bigger advantage. Republicans have asked the U.S. Supreme Court and U.S. District Court to intervene and stop the implementation of the court's congressional map. There are also calls to impeach the 5 justices on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court who struck down the GOP map. This is a closely watched battle that could have national implications, and it's our topic for today's Radio Times. Joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Laura Olson, D.C. correspondent for the Allentown Morning Call. And Laura, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Also with us is Nicholas Stephanopoulos. He's also a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. And Nicholas Stephanopoulos, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Nick, let me go to you and actually quote something that came from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And this is Deborah McCloskey Todd, one of the justices, one of the justices on the court. She said, and this is talking about the old GOP map, an election corrupted by extensive, sophisticated gerrymandering and partisan dilution of votes is not free and equal. The General Assembly has, in fact, interfered to prevent the free exercise of the right of suffrage. Does the old, or I guess the map that's under contention, does it prevent Pennsylvania voters from exercising their free right to vote?
I think so. The Pennsylvania congressional map was one of the most gerrymandered in the country. Pennsylvania is a classic swing state. It's roughly evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans. And yet, in every single election held under the old congressional plan, Republican candidates were consistently winning 13 out of 18 seats, and Democratic candidates were winning 5 seats. None of this was accidental. This was exactly what the crafters of the old map intended, and that's what happened in 2012 and 2014 and 2016. That's exactly what the court means by the dilution of the vote. You know, Democratic voters in Pennsylvania simply didn't have the same kind of opportunity to be represented that Republican voters in the state had.
I think we know what gerrymander looks like. The 7th Congressional District, I think, is a perfect example of that. Going back to you, Nick, and then, Laura, I'll get you in on the conversation. Do we know what ungerrymandered districts look like?
Yeah, I think the key is not to get too hung up on district shape. Weird district shapes are a clue that something is going on, you know, something other than a desire to represent communities, to follow city and county boundaries. But the real key is to think about the map in its entirety. That's what the creators of the map do. And so an ungerrymandered map is one that treats both parties symmetrically or fairly. You know, it's one that gives a reasonably fair shot to both sides at winning representation that's consistent with their numbers in the state. And that's exactly what the Pennsylvania court's remedy looks like, which I'm sure we'll get to.
We will indeed get to that. Laura, let's talk about the process. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court drew this map. They released it earlier this week. How did they come up with the boundaries that they did?
So this map is the latest in a series of maps that we saw submitted to the court, first with one from the Republican legislative leaders who were directed by the state Supreme Court to draw a map. Governor Wolf then rejected that map, proposed his own, and the various other parties that were involved in the case also got to submit their own suggestions. And the court said that, you know, they crafted their map with a reflection of the record that had been built in the case. They also had some outside help. A Stanford law professor was hired to help them draw this map. And so when you look at what the Supreme Court had said, they had directed the legislators and then presumably in their own map drawer as well to draw districts that were more compact, more contiguous, and districts that have equal population. And when you look at this map compared to the current map and the other maps that had been submitted, this splits fewer counties. Only two fewer than the Republican-drawn map, but still fewer. So those counties, those districts are much more compact and more reasonably shaped, which is where more of the focus of this has been. But they also were able to advantage some Democrats in those districts because the big difference between these two maps is that this one would be much more favorable to Democrats compared to the ones drawn by Republicans. And we should add that it is a Democratic majority on the state Supreme Court.
Indeed. And I guess anytime you talk about redistricting, it is a partisan issue. Nick, let me go back to you then. Looking at this new map, is it just the Democratic version of gerrymander, or does it make elections more competitive in Pennsylvania and give voters the options that they need and require?
Yeah, so you know, this map is nowhere near a Democratic gerrymander of Pennsylvania. If you wanted to, you could certainly create a map in Pennsylvania that would give Democrats 11, 12, 13 of the congressional districts in Pennsylvania. You know, it's a real error to use as the baseline for comparison the old Republican gerrymandered map. The baseline should be either perfect fairness or what you might expect if somebody drew districts randomly in Pennsylvania without even considering election results. And by either of those benchmarks, the court's map is very impressively neutral. It gives both sides an advantage in about the same number of districts, and it's also exactly consistent with what the plaintiff's expert showed you would expect if you randomly drew hundreds of maps for Pennsylvania. The expert found that the typical randomly generated congressional map in Pennsylvania had 9 Democratic seats and 9 Republican seats. That's about what the court-drawn plan does as well, maybe even tilting a little bit in a Republican direction compared to these randomly generated maps.
And we are talking about maps on the radio, which is always tricky, but we are talking about redistricting, which is such an important issue. Nick, let me just go back to you. My understanding is that in drawing these maps, the person who did it, Nate Persily, we should add, who used to be at University of Pennsylvania and has been a guest on Radio Times, he looked at presidential voting. How does that square up with congressional voting?
So there's a very strong relationship between presidential and congressional voting these days. This wasn't always the case, but it is the case now in the 2010s. That's because most voters have pretty strong party affiliations, and so they tend to cast their ballots for the same party, both at the presidential level and at the congressional level. The big exception to this is the so-called incumbency advantage. So incumbents typically do a little bit better than we would expect, given the presidential vote in their districts. And that's because a small number of voters, you know, 3%, 4%, 5%, split their tickets when there's an incumbent running. They might vote for Hillary Clinton for president, but for the Republican incumbent whom they know and like in their district. So the presidential vote plus incumbency together pretty much accounts for almost all of the patterns that we observe in the congressional vote.
Laura, let me go back to you, and let's talk about Ryan Costello. It seems as if of all the members of the House of Representatives in Pennsylvania, his district is, for him at least, at risk.
Yeah, you have to assume that out of the delegation, he was probably one of the least enthusiastic when he saw this map come out earlier this week. His Chester County district, and we should note that there were a couple of districts in Pennsylvania where voters did split their ticket between the presidential party pick and their congressional party pick. And Ryan Costello's district and Pat Meehan's neighboring district both went for Hillary Clinton while they sent Republicans to the U.S. House. But his district down in Chester County becomes much more Democratic friendly. It loses a couple of Democratic or a couple of Republican strongholds within it and picks up the city of Reading, which is a very Democratic heavy area. And that puts him in a much more vulnerable position going into this reelection battle. It also includes the top Democratic challenger that Democrats had recruited, Chrissy Houlihan, who has been working to take him on. So it puts him in a much more vulnerable position.
You mentioned Pat Meehan. He and Charlie Dent, I believe there's some other retirements as well. How do you think, Laura, that factors into whatever happens this year in these House races in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, the interesting thing about this year is that even before this map saga unfolded, we had a whole range of interesting layers to the map unfolding in Pennsylvania. We have a midterm year in which typically the party that's out of power it has a little bit of favor leaning towards it. We have some Democratic activists and liberal voters who have been really energized against the president. And then we have this wave of retirements, mostly among Republican members of the U.S. House delegation. You mentioned Charlie Dent, Pat right. Meehan, Bill Schuster, a longtime serving Congress member from out in the western part of the state. When you add up all of the changes, there were already going to be six new faces coming into the 18-member delegation. And one interesting way that this all kind of wraps in with redistricting as well is the way that incumbents factor into how the maps generally play out. And we saw that in 2011 when Congressman Joe Pitts, who lived in Chester County, very near to several other lawmakers in the southeast, was still representing the 16th district. And that kind of was one of the factors at play as the 7th district wrapped around the 16th district in order to keep him in that district. And in the process, kind of made the southeastern portion of that map much more complicated, much stranger looking, and much more, as the court said, gerrymandered.
Nick, we're almost having a break here, but is the goal then in redistricting to make races more competitive?
I think competitiveness is an important value. You know, having close elections means that voters are more engaged. It means the representatives are held more accountable to voters. But I don't think that competitiveness is the real value that's threatened by partisan gerrymandering. The real harm of a partisan gerrymander is clear from its name. It's the unwarranted partisan advantage for one side or another. So making districts more competitive, I think, is a good thing in general. But it's not the cure for a partisan gerrymander. The cure for a partisan gerrymander is not having the partisan skew.
Fair enough. Let's take a very short break talking about Pennsylvania, gerrymandering, redistricting, talking with Laura Olson and Nicholas Stephanopoulos. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. We are talking about the battle over congressional maps in Pennsylvania. Joining us, Nicholas Stephanopoulos, University of Chicago Law School professor, and Laura Olson, reporter for the Allentown Morning Call. And you can call us and join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. Nick, let me go back to you because the Republicans are challenging what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court did, appealing both to the U.S. Supreme Court and to district court. Part of their argument is to say this is not your job. It's the job of the legislature to come up with boundaries for these voting districts. Where does the law stand on this?
The law stands essentially unanimously against the Republicans' argument. You know, they're relying on one provision in the Constitution known as the Elections Clause, which says that the legislature thereof, the legislature of a state, gets to design congressional maps and handle all the other aspects of congressional elections in the state. The trouble for the Pennsylvania Republicans is that the court for a century has held that the word legislature in that clause is a reference to the entire political process in the state as contemplated by the state constitution. And so that can include a gubernatorial veto, that can include a voter initiative, and that can also include a court interpreting the state constitution to revise or to strike down a congressional map. And so that's the fatal problem with the Pennsylvania Republicans' argument, that the word that they've latched onto has been interpreted by the court to include all of the elements of the state lawmaking process, including the role of the judiciary.
Well, let me get Betsy from Winmore to join our conversation. She has a question or comment to speak to just that. Betsy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. As you know, Fair Districts PA is proposing legislation that includes an independent citizens redistricting commission and an open and transparent redistricting process, including numerous public hearings. I'm just curious, what do you think would have been the result in terms of the reputation of the Supreme Court had it, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, had it maybe engaged in a truncated process similar to what the Fair Districts PA legislation is proposing?
The idea of being more transparent about coming up with this new map?
Yeah, had they been more transparent, maybe held a public hearing, maybe gotten more buy-in by the citizens.
It's a good question. Lord, can I throw that to you?
I think one of the interesting parts of this process is that regardless of what your view of the 2011 drafted map, it doesn't seem like anyone would want to repeat the process that we've gone through over the past month, that this is not exactly the ideal way to be drawing maps. The Republican lawmakers didn't pass a bill. They were doing it at the last minute due to other legal challenges. They basically sent a county outline map and a list of municipalities to the governor. The governor then quickly rejected those, and the Supreme Court drew their map. This doesn't seem to be the ideal way at all to be drawing maps. So regardless of how this all plays out, there's still the larger question of how to make the process more fair, because it seems like there is agreement that the ways that we have been drawing lines aren't working. So how do you fix that? Is it an independent commission of some sort, which other states have used? Are there other ways to take some of the politics out of this, or at least make it a little bit more balanced? I think that's a larger question, a larger debate that Pennsylvania is going to have as we come upon 2021 after the next census when we draw new lines again.
Laura, is this call for impeachment of the Democrats sitting on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and we should say that we elect our judiciary in Pennsylvania, is that gathering steam, the idea of impeachment?
There's been more discussion about it this week after the map came out, and Republicans were clearly and vocally frustrated with the way that the map came out. We saw Senator Toomey say, hey, maybe we should take a look at it. Congressman Costello also has been talking about it. There isn't legislation moving in Harrisburg at the moment. There's, a co-sponsorship memo from a rank-and-file Republican, but there doesn't seem to be a building effort to actually take action on it yet, but it's definitely a way that Republicans have been expressing their frustration with the way this is all playing out.
Nick, any precedent for that?
It's not unusual for politicians in a state to be really threatened when a court disrupts their hold on power. I would just point out how absurd this whole movement is to consider impeachment. Under the old map, Pennsylvania basically didn't have a proper democracy when it comes to its congressional elections. The court intervened to fix this problem, to essentially restore democracy to the state when it comes to congressional elections. And, you know, for that, for fixing a broken system, you want to impeach the court. You know, the court ought to be applauded for stepping in when there was no other actor who was capable of stepping in to fix a rotten system.
But picking up what Laura said, though, Nick, I mean, could the court have been more open and transparent so that, for instance, this would not be before the U.S. Supreme Court or U.S. District Court?
So I think the trouble for the court was that it set its own remedial deadline so soon that there wasn't enough time for Professor Persily to hold a hearing, to gather input from voters and from groups around the state. There is precedent in other court-drawn plans in other states for the court listening a bit to groups around the state. And I think here that just wasn't possible because of the compressed timetable for coming up with a remedy. I agree it's far from ideal for a new map to be announced without having had hearings and input from people that are concerned about redistricting throughout the state.
Well, we are talking about the fight over gerrymandering or redistricting that's taking place in Pennsylvania. That's Nicholas Stephanopoulos, University of Chicago Law School professor, Laura Olson, reporter for the Allentown Morning Call, our guest as we talk about where this is all going. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a tweet that says the GOP will say splitting off one area of Philadelphia violates the Voting Rights Act. I read that Common Cause Pennsylvania, the NAACP Pennsylvania, are considering, Nick, that this new map drawn by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court could violate the 1965 Voting Rights Act because of what it does to Philadelphia. Is that an important issue?
Compliance with the Voting Rights Act is definitely an important issue for any district plan anywhere in the country. But I think there is just about no possibility of there being a successful Voting Rights Act claim here. And that's for several reasons. The most important reason is just that the new districts are identical demographically in the Philadelphia area to the old districts. And so if the old districts did not violate the Voting Rights Act, there's really no way to argue that the new districts somehow do. So Pennsylvania continues to have one majority African-American district in the new map, just as it did in the old map. And Pennsylvania continues to have exactly one coalition district where African-Americans and Latino voters together comprise the effective majority. There was one of those districts before, and there's one of those districts now. So if you look at the demographic composition of the key districts in Philadelphia before and after, there's been effectively no change whatsoever. And so I think that is fatal to any Voting Rights Act claim.
Let me read a tweet from Edward Dallara. He says, why was this done during a congressional election year? Why not next year? It is most unfair to the people of Pennsylvania. I'm worried about not knowing my candidate. And in some places, two congressmen might have to run against each other for one new district. How much, assuming that this map coming from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is upheld, will there be mass confusion across the state of Pennsylvania?
There's definitely confusion. We've been talking to congressional candidates who've been working for almost the last year, trying to get to know the area, talk to voters about issues, and are now at a loss for whether that is all for naught, let alone the voters who are trying to figure out who they need to be paying attention to and who their choices are for the May 15th primary that's coming up very, very quickly here. So there's definitely confusion. There's even more confusion out in the western part of the state. There's a special election in what is currently the 18th Congressional District on March 13th. That's the district that Republican Tim Murphy stepped down from in October. So voters there will be heading to the polls to choose between Democrat Connor Lamb and Republican Rick Saccone. Now, 2 months later, they will be going back to the polls, voting in a whole new district.
Wow.
And for a portion of that district, neither the Democrat nor the Republican that they will be choosing between in just a couple weeks will live within their district. Connor Lamb would be in the 12th district with Republican Keith, or what was the 12th district with Republican Keith Rathfuss under the proposed
map.
It's
confusing, right?
It is. It is. And they renumbered the districts, which makes it even worse. And then the Republican would also be penciled in with another incumbent lawmaker. Mm. So explaining that to voters who, especially those who are going to go to the polls twice in the next couple months, is just a lot to process.
Well, Nick, let me give you a chance to respond to that. I mean, part of redistricting, of course, is moving some of these boundaries. But what are voters owed, I guess, in terms of understanding where they're going to vote and who they're going to vote for? Especially when it's all going to happen within the next couple of months.
Yeah, any time that you have redistricting, you always have some voter confusion. You know, the lines change. That means some voters are placed into new districts with new candidates running in those new districts. That's just inevitable with any redistricting. And you have to weigh that voter confusion against the dramatic improvement in partisan fairness that we're getting with the remedial map. I would just note that the court's special master, Professor Persily, bent backwards to ensure that no current incumbents would be paired in any of the new districts.
Hmm.
I actually think that's not appropriate. You know, I think if you're trying to correct a partisan gerrymander, you don't focus on where the beneficiaries of the current gerrymander happen to live. But whether it's right or wrong, Professor Persily avoided pairing any of the incumbents. And so I think that you could have had much more voter confusion under lots of other possible configurations. The court's actual remedy seems to be designed to keep voter confusion, maybe not to a minimum, but to reduce it relative to what it could have been.
Let me get Ken from Lansdale to join our conversation. And Ken, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
This morning. My question is this. Since the U.S. Supreme Court refused to issue a stay, essentially, I guess, telling the Republicans you've got no case, by what logic would any lower federal court even agree to hear this? I'll take my answer off the air.
Ken, it's a good question. Nick, I'm tossing that back to you.
Well, so the Republican legislative leaders are currently trying two legal strategies. One is to ask the Supreme Court for another stay now that there's actually been a map announced by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And the second tactic is to file a whole new federal lawsuit in front of a federal district court. Both of those approaches have the exact same problem. They're both based exclusively on the Elections Clause theory that we talked about earlier, that only the Pennsylvania legislature is supposed to get a say as to what congressional districts look like. I think there's a very good chance that the new lawsuit in front of the district court will just be tossed out by the court, partly on the grounds that, look, the Supreme Court now will have thrice denied the request for a stay on the exact same ground.
Laura, let me go back to you. How much are outside of Pennsylvania party leaders looking at this fight over maps in Pennsylvania?
So nationally, Democrats would need 24 to pick up 24 seats in the U.S. House if they're going to win back control of that chamber from the Republicans who currently control the agenda there. This map would help significantly in that role by making some of these districts that were already tipping towards Democrats even more favorable towards Democrats. It gives them, shores up not only some of the possibilities that they had already been eyeing and investing money and recruiting candidates, but it opens up a couple more as well. So there's definitely a handful of seats that could get the party nationally closer to that goal, and that would be a significant development.
An email from Stu, why not simply use county borders and never redistrict again? Nick, can you take that?
Sure. The trouble is that for about 50 years, the Supreme Court has insisted that congressional districts have to have virtually identical populations. And so, you know, obviously Pennsylvania counties don't happen to neatly have multiples or divisors of the ideal population for congressional districts. So if you're going to comply with the legal requirement of perfect population equality, it's inevitable that you're going to have to split a fair number of counties around the state. There's no possible legal map for Pennsylvania that doesn't split, 10 or 15 counties.
Here's an email from Casey. Do you suspect that the new map will produce more centrist candidates or more competitive elections? Laura, I'm asking you to look into your crystal ball. Did you think it will change who runs and who gets not just more votes, but who can appeal and perhaps even a different kind of way?
I think that's kind of a district-by-district question. If you look at what had been the 15th district, now the 7th district, where Republican Charlie Dent is retiring, we had already seen a wide range of candidates who are stepping up to fill that that seat based on his retirement before the map case came to its current status. And some of those candidates now have been drawn out of the districts, but we're also seeing some new candidates get in because the district is now more favorable towards the Democratic Party. So we've seen kind of a range of folks stepping forward, some on the more progressive end of the spectrum, some on more of the conservative end of the spectrum. And it's going to be a very interesting primary to see how each of these districts plays out and what those primary voters are looking for, because those will significantly shape what the elections look like across the state this fall.
Nick, is this a test case for fixing gerrymandering in the United States?
It's a really interesting case because it's the first of this new batch of partisan gerrymandering lawsuits to get to remedial phase. I've worked a lot on similar lawsuits in other states, in Wisconsin and in North Carolina, but those have all been under the federal constitution, and the Supreme Court has stayed the remedial processes in those states. And so Pennsylvania is fascinating because it's the first place where we've confronted the question of what does a remedy for a partisan gerrymander look like? Once you strike down a plan, what happens next? And I really like the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's answer, which is that you don't just need a pretty map to replace the gerrymander. You need a map that's not diluting the votes of voters in the state anymore. You need a balanced and fair map. And so I think in that respect, Pennsylvania, is a terrific precedent. And
we
got
to run.
Precedent.
Nick Stephanopoulos, Laura Olson, sorry to do that. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Sure.
I'm Marty Moskowanen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Back in 2000, there was concern about the integrity of the vote with butterfly ballots and hanging chads. More recently, there were calls for voter ID laws because of allegations, never proved, of widespread voter fraud. And this month, the U.S. government confirmed that several states' voting systems were hacked by Russians, with evidence already of meddling in the 2018 election. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf has ordered counties to buy voting machines that have a paper trail as a way to audit the vote. We asked Lawrence Norden to join us. He's deputy director of the Democracy Program at New York University's Brennan Center for Justice. Larry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Here's kind of a broad-based question, but based on my very short introduction there, why do we still struggle to have a secure way of voting in this country?
Well, in some sense, this is a new problem in terms of security and cybersecurity around election systems. After the 2000 election, as you mentioned, the Help America Vote Act was passed, and we moved to really computerized voting around the country. With the growth of the internet and cyber threats, that's presented a new challenge to election system security, and it's something that I think we weren't really thinking about back in 2004, 2005, when everybody around the country was purchasing new machines. The other challenge, of course, is that computers are you just can't keep them for as long as you did for things like lever machines that existed before, or even punch card machines, although obviously those systems, as we learned in Florida in 2000, had their own huge problems.
Yes, they did, indeed. Do we know the extent of the Russian hacking?
So I think we are learning more all the time. But in terms of hacking into election systems, I think this is a very important distinction to make. What we know so far about Russian hacking was only hacks against attempts to hack registration systems or probe registration systems. In one case in Illinois, apparently they actually broke through, although they didn't change any information. Registration systems are not voting machines. Registration systems are the lists of people, you know, that are then used to allow people to vote. So that's very different than the counting of votes, which I think is what people often think about when they hear hacking into voting systems or election systems.
Pennsylvania governor, as I mentioned, has called for new voting machines, I guess, when districts need them or, I guess, get the money for them. What will that do? Yeah. And this is with this paper backup. It's for security reasons, yeah. Obviously, the ability to audit. But are we going backwards here?
I don't think we're going backwards. Again, after 2000, I think a lot of people said, I never want to see a recount again.
I remember that well.
So,
yes.
So a lot of states moved to systems that had no paper anymore. The problem with that, again, when you're dealing with cybersecurity threats is, and actually, frankly, not just cybersecurity threats, but software failure. Software has bugs in it sometimes. You want some kind of backup record, some kind of resilience, so that if there is a problem, you can go back and find something that you know is cannot be corrupted by the software and is the voter's record of choice. And in fact, you want to use that paper, that backup, just to double check all the time. I think it's a good practice to do those kinds of audits. I would say the challenge with the governor's order is, and by the way, you know, having a paper backup, doing audits is now, I think, security experts across the country, even the Department of Homeland Security, everybody says that's best practice. 83% of voters in Pennsylvania are voting on paperless systems, and we just completed a survey of election officials, 35 election officials in counties across Pennsylvania. Almost none of them, one county, said they had enough money to replace their system. So even though there's this order to make sure that new systems are verifiable, have a paper record, it is not at all clear, unless the legislature provides some money, that's going to happen anytime soon. And that's troubling.
Well, and since Pennsylvania really doesn't have the kind of voting machines that you're talking about, would it if they were all implemented and put in place, is it a matter of getting a receipt when you vote, or how does a paper ballot work? And you can tell we're a little bit behind the times here.
Yeah, so there are two main systems. One is, and some people in Pennsylvania do vote on what are called optical scan systems. So you're filling out a paper ballot. Usually, it's like filling out like you would a lottery ticket or a Scantron that people may remember from standardized tests, where you're filling in bubbles with a pen for your choices. And then there are, and that frankly is where, you know, it may sound old-fashioned, but it's where most of the country has been moving. There's been a dramatic move to that kind of system, and then it's scanned into a computer that records the votes, tallies them up. But again, you can always go back to that paper record and check the software. The other system, which is a little bit less favored these days, is a touchscreen machine that prints out something that the voter can see and says, here are your choices. And that can be used later to check the electronic voting machine.
Because I think a lot of people, and myself included, sometimes you do your civic duty, and once you pull the curtain back, once you've voted, there is that question, I wonder if my vote got registered. Just whether there is that trust of the machine. I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just saying there is that question when you walk away from the machine.
Yes, and I think people should feel good that their vote is going to be counted. You know, in some sense, having the paper record has confirmed this for us, because we do in much of the country you do have these post-election audits where you're checking and saying, okay, this is what the piece of paper said. does it match up with what the machine is saying? And invariably, it has. But I do have a concern with social media and all the kinds of bad information and propaganda that gets on there. And frankly, with what we know the Russians have done, not necessarily in the United States, but in other countries, in trying to cast doubt over the integrity of results and in the idea of democracy generally, that if we don't have those paper records and if we don't do a kind of public audit, that a lot more people will doubt. And that would really be the terrible outcome of these kinds of attacks.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Lawrence Norden. He's deputy director of the Democracy Program at New York University's Brennan Center for Justice. We are talking about the integrity of the vote. And Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf has ordered counties to buy voting machines that have a paper trail. But as our guest said, if there isn't money to back that up, it's not clear when those voting machines will be available for the public to use. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Larry, let me talk to you about President Trump's Election Integrity Commission. It has been disbanded. The goal, it seemed, was to determine if there was widespread voter fraud. Tell us about this commission and what it did and what it didn't do.
Well, I think the goal, from what I remember, was that President Trump had argued that he actually won the popular vote and that there were about 3 million illegal votes cast. And so that was, from what I recall, that was the impetus for the commission. I would say, you know, unlike the cybersecurity threat, which we have a lot of evidence that threat is real, not right, just in the voting context, but in every walk of life, and where the experts agree that this is something that really needs to be addressed. There have been decades of study on the problem of illegal voting, and it is extraordinarily rare. And I think that at the end of the day, the commission was set up to find something that didn't exist, and that was part of the problem for the commission, is that at the end of the day, they weren't able to find it and were forced to be disbanded.
But does that mean, and Pennsylvania had this voter ID debate, and it was essentially there wasn't the proof of widespread voter fraud in Pennsylvania, and so the voter ID went away. How about in other states? Is that still an issue?
Yeah, I think it's always an issue. And, you know, I would say we all want integrity in our elections, and the key thing that you should be looking out for is, what is the problem that's being identified, and does the solution, if the problem exists, actually address that problem, and is it implemented in a way where we can ensure that everybody who is eligible to vote still gets to vote? Those are the main questions that we should be asking for us. And unfortunately, election administration has become really politicized in the United States, certainly again since the 2000 election, where both sides often are trying to gain advantage in changing the rules. And really, the goal, as far as I'm concerned, should be what I said: make sure that we have integrity in the election, make sure that all people can vote. And that's not always what's driving the conversation. So we do still have this issue in much of the country where we have very restrictive laws in terms of what kind of ID has to be presented to vote that prevents people from voting. We have a lot of arguments over things like early voting that I think that the conversation, unfortunately, gets very skewed.
We also have a very decentralized system of how we vote with local precincts and districts. Does that help our system? Does it hurt it? Is it? I mean, this is the way we do things, mm-hmm. but what do you think the impact is?
When you're talking, for instance, going back to the cybersecurity threat, I think it has the pluses and minuses. the plus, I suppose, is that, you know, again, we're talking about something like cybersecurity. There's not one point of entry to attack all votes in the United States. So that's definitely a benefit. On the other hand, As somebody said to me, an election official I was interviewing, you're as strong as your weakest link. And when you have 9,000 election jurisdictions in the United States, each responsible for running elections, often you're talking about jurisdictions that maybe have one person in the election office. Defending that with that one person in the office against, you know, potentially a state actor that is looking to wreak havoc in your elections creates lots of challenges, as anybody can imagine. And so kind of having that floor of standards and security is a challenge when it's so dispersed.
We've got George calling us from Hatboro. And George, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Yes.
Hi there.
Good morning. It interests me that no one has mentioned all the involvement of the United States government after World War II the elections of most of the major countries, including Japan, if you want to go that far, and the minor countries in South America. And if you look at the history, we were very critical in getting Yeltsin elected in Russia, but nobody's brought this up.
Well, it has been brought up from time to time, but I'm glad, George, you brought it up. And I'd be interested, Larry, in what you say. This is a slightly different conversation, but it's about whether the United States has clean hands when it comes to meddling in other countries' elections.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is not something that I'm an expert on in terms of the history of the U.S. in meddling in other elections. And certainly there are some bad facts in the history of the United States, but I never really understand the relevance of that in terms of talking about making sure that we're protecting our own elections and our sovereignty going forward. I think, regardless of what that history is, and we may need to look at it and explore it, I think most Americans would agree that we want to make sure that we maintain the system that we have, that we maintain confidence in that system, and that it works for people. Regardless of our past involved in other nations' elections, it seems a worthy goal to make sure that we protect the integrity of our elections and our system going forward.
George, thanks for the call. Larry, what about our databases? Are they up to date?
Our registration databases, again, you know, we have a problem in the United States, and this goes to your question about how decentralized we are. It's not really clear who's in charge of election system infrastructure and making sure that things are up to date and making sure that we're funding them adequately. And just as with voting machines, we did this survey of election officials across the country, and in 33 states, election officials told us that they thought they needed to replace their equipment by 2020 because it was so old. The same applies for registration databases. They're computerized. A lot of them are, for various reasons, outdated and antiquated and need to be updated. But, you know, who is responsible for that? Is it the federal government? Is it the states? Is it the locals? I would say it should probably be some combination, but it's not a high priority for anybody, and that's a problem.
30 seconds before we have to say goodbye to you, what about the Secure Elections Act? Where does that stand, and what would that do?
So it's the most promising thing right now in terms of, for many years, in fact, in terms of providing money to the states to upgrade election systems. It will provide about $400 million to the states to upgrade voting machines, to replace the paperless systems like you have in Pennsylvania with systems that produce paper. And it will provide other basic cybersecurity protections for states and localities around the country. So I think it's really important. It's bipartisan. It's got three Republicans and three Democrats in the Senate, led by Senators Lankford and Klobuchar. So I'm hopeful that something moves soon. It's been too long that we've been waiting to do this.
Thank you so much, Larry, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And that's Lawrence Norden, Deputy Director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri, with assistance today from Susan Greenbaum. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.